Hey, Mike.
Hello, Alice.
So we've just finished the production of this new episode. Can a mother, sorry, we keep doing that. It's supposed to be, can a father be a mother? And we've been switching on and off in this episode between thoughts about fathers and mothers, but tell me what your final thoughts are.
Well, I was, it was comforting to talk to a couple of other hyper-involved male parents, fathers, and while our perspectives aren't 100% aligned on everything, I mean, there's definitely more in common than there are differences. And I include you with that, even though you're not a male parent. But I think
Although,
our,
as you recall, my son called me dad for several
yes,
years.
but our perspectives and our experiences have more in common than not. And that was, it was comforting for me to hear that, even though they're all, different locations, different ages, different experiences, different families, but that was nice. So, how about yourself?
I'm just going to say that I feel like while we've been doing this episode, we've been living the cycle of life. People will hear some of that in the recordings that we did in this episode. But I will also just say, you just put your son down for a nap, and I just put my father down for a nap. So
Yes.
we are kind of in a similar situation on opposite ends of the life spectrum. So
Yes,
let's do it.
after running around all morning to take him to cello, and then I had to go buy him an outfit for his cello recital that's coming up. And so it's like a day of child madness around
Whereas
here.
I was helping my father use Amazon to watch more John Wayne movies.
Yeah.
right, this is great. I love this episode. Let's let people listen to it. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off.
Thing happened on the way to production of this episode. We had finished all the interviews for it, and I was supposed to get Mike Teeger, my producer, the draft script before he left for his annual vacation with his mom in Las Vegas. But then it turned out that my kid, who is now 21, ended up with a registration disaster at college. It looked like he wasn't going to graduate on time because of lacking one class. My son was understandably pretty upset, as were I and his father. So, although these days my kid generally doesn't need me at all, except maybe to pay his bursar bill, with his permission I stepped in to help. The problem he was facing was confusing and complicated, and it was made messier by my son's deep pessimism about being able to solve it. It took a lot of my attention to figure out how this problem could be solved, and it had to be solved very fast because we were already well past normal class add deadlines. My spouse cared very much about it all, but his work life went on as usual. As expected, he was promoted this week to be dean of his medical school. Meanwhile, between the endless bureaucracy that I had to stay right on top of and the stress of seeing my son, who is usually quite chill, being so stressed out himself, I basically lost 2 days of work on this episode. Mike headed off to Las Vegas without the draft script that I had promised him. This is kind of ironic because the episode Mike and I were working on, this episode, is about being the primary caregiver to your child, something Mike and I have both done. As you'll hear about in this episode, our having both done this is the thing that started our now 7-year friendship. It's still today the shared experience at the very core of our friendship. Mike and I met when my son was 14 and his was a baby. I was surprised to meet a man who had done what I had done, and to be honest, I could see in his experience with his baby so much of what I had experienced, and it made me feel witnessed. I could see he was really in love with his kid, but that he felt the same intermittent boredom and frustration that I had had with a baby. He seemed just as committed, but also just as bewildered as I had been. Like, what just happened to the adult life I worked pretty hard to create? For both of us, being a primary caregiver working parent meant making a conscious decision to be the parent who would, on a daily basis, subsume their own professional work to the kid's life. To help out with the class field trip to the zoo or to the pumpkin patch. To take the kid to the doctor and the dentist and the music lessons. To be the person who will still, when the kid is 21, drop everything when there's a crisis to be emotionally and physically present as a parent. We both do it in part so that our spouses can carry on without their careers being constantly interrupted by the requirements of good parenting. In my case, when my son was 4, I gave up a tenure-track job at Michigan State University and took a long-distance but very part-time job at Northwestern University, 200 miles away from home. I did it in large part so I could be physically and emotionally present as a parent. For the 10 years I had my Northwestern job, most people thought I had a full-time tenured position. The truth was that I was basically an adjunct with an international reputation in research, writing, and public speaking, which I wrapped around being at the bus stop almost every morning and almost every afternoon. Listen, I'm not pretending at all that this is some kind of selfless, heroic way of life. As you'll hear about in this episode, Mike and I both feel real ambivalence about what we've experienced. You'll hear about times when we wanted to rip our eyes out with frustration, and you'll hear about why we have each stuck it out, even though we sometimes resented the positions we were in. You'll also hear from one of my friends who's in a very different kind of parenting arrangement with his husband. To get started, I want to draw from the interview we did with Paul Sullivan, who just launched a new venture called The Company of Dads. Paul is well known for his journalism career, but he's had a secret life, no, not as a spy, as the primary caregiver to his 3 daughters. It's an arrangement that's allowed his wife, who is a financial advisor, to have a relatively uninterrupted professional life. So, Paul, first I have to read your big fancy bio. So, Paul Sullivan, we're thrilled he's with us today. He's a journalist with 25 years' experience and so many impressive bylines, including in Fortune, Money, the International Herald Tribune, Barron's, the Boston Globe, Food and Wine, and more. And he's the author of 2 books. The one, the title I like the best is The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. I hope someday to be subject to the follow-up to that book. And I hope it's not about the super poor. He wrote the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times for 13 years, and he's the founder of The Company of Dads, which is the first platform dedicated to creating a community for what he calls lead dads. And its mission is, quote, to help make lead dads feel less isolated and more confident that they have made the correct choice to take on the bulk of the parenting and family duties, or at the very least, not embrace stereotypes around who does what at home, unquote. He lives with his wife and 3 daughters and way too many pets in Connecticut in what he describes as, quote, a town where working moms like my wife aren't common. So first, Paul, I want to ask you, why do you have so many pets? I understand there are 3 cats, 3 dogs, and 3 fish. Are you trying to compensate for something, or are you trying to hint to your wife that you want more children?
No, it's just easier if everything's the same. So if I have, you know, 3 daughters, 3 dogs, 3 cats, 3 fish, and you know, one of the fish isn't looking too good, and that'll screw everything up.
Well, fish you can replace quickly, right?
That's so cold-hearted.
It's not like a dog. I mean, a dog you have to mourn for 6 to 9 months before you can replace them.
Well, the
children, I don't know. I haven't checked.
The crazy thing is, my lucky number is 5, so it could be worse. I could have 5 children, 5 dogs, 5 cats. But we found out in the town that we live in New Canaan, there is a rule that if you have over 6 pets, and evidently fish don't count, if you have over 6 pets, you need to apply for sort of like a mini farm license.
A hoarder license.
I guess, yeah. I mean.
So I should just explain by way of background that the reason we're doing this episode is, maybe you don't know this, because Mike and I kind of bonded over being lead parents, and we met through a newspaper that I founded for the town of East Lansing. I do national stuff, but my own town was lacking a newspaper, so I started one. And Mike was on the Arts Commission, so he had been watching the city stupidity along with the rest of us. And so he joined the reporting team part-time. And he and I got to know each other, and I realized he had done what I had done, which is basically choose to be the lead parent. And I felt kind of... I didn't relate to the women who did this because I felt very ambivalent about it in ways they didn't admit to. I think they also felt ambivalent, but I felt open ambivalence. So Mike and I got to bonding over that. And I think to this day, we still sort of bond over that issue about, you know, having to deal with, in some ways, adjusting our schedules in ways that our spouses don't have to do. I still remember, though, you know, I gave up tenure at Michigan State when my kid was four because I couldn't balance everything I was doing. And I realized my job was the thing I was not really enjoying. And I still remember the one time where, like, a few weeks into my new life of working from home and doing other stuff that did not require me to show up at an office every day, it snowed and preschool closed. And my husband turned to me with that look that we had had towards each other all those years of like, oh, who's going to do it? And then he was like, oh my God, you're home. Thank you. So I'm sure you've had some of those moments where your wife is like, thank you.
There is nothing worse than when school closes. And like, I live in Southern Connecticut. I grew up in Massachusetts back when we had, you know, real winter. And, you know, we went to school no matter what. And now I live in a town where, I don't know, 90% of the people have some form of four-wheel drive vehicle. I'm like, come on, it's 3 inches, you know?
So do other parents try to dump their kids on you? Because I found people started doing that. And I was like, yeah, no, I didn't actually quit my job to raise your children.
No, part of it, why I started the Company of Dads is I kept it secret for so long because around town I was known as Paul Sullivan, you know, New York Times columnist. I was a Times columnist for 13 years. I've been a dad for 12 and a half. So it sort of almost perfectly, you know, overlapped. And that's part of, you know, how do you make something like this normal? How do you make being, you know, the lead parent, if you're a man, normal and not something where you either get, you know, a ridiculous amount of credit for doing something simple like raising a child, which you know, is what we're supposed to do, or, you know, make it completely strange. And so I would, you know, appear at, you know, the pediatrician's office, the birthday parties, the ballet recital, always with my laptop, even if I didn't have any work to do, just because I was like, you know, yeah, you know, you don't know I'm the lead dad. You know, I'm a New York Times columnist. And it just sort of, you know, in COVID, I said, God, this is ridiculous. Like, instead of, you know, pretending I should be happy, but if I'm really happy about this, where's that community? You know, where's that community that I would have if I was stay-at-home mom? Stay-at-home moms have plenty of community. You know, traditional go-to-work dads, at least where I live, they take the train into the city. They you know, get lunch with their friends. They get a beer after work with their friends. They have community. You know, working moms, you know, towns really push to give, you know, working moms a community. But a lead dad, it's, you know, this you know, key parenting demographic that doesn't have a community. And that's really what I wanted to put my energy behind. So there wouldn't be this, you know, ridiculous shame or ridiculous, you know, stuttering about, you know, the yes, but. It's like, no, you know, I'm a lead dad and this is why it's important. And this is why it's you know, going to hopefully make the world, you know, just a teeny bit better, at least not any worse.
Paul is trying to help men feel less shame or embarrassment about being primary caregivers, helping them not feel embarrassed or emasculated by being the parent whose day is bookended by baby vomit or getting gum out of the kid's hair or settling fights between the kids in the back seat on the way to basketball practice. So in your bio, you write that you understand, quote, intimately the joys, frustrations, isolation, and reticence around talking about being a lead dad. It's a role that is growing in numbers, but is far from normalized. And I was wondering what you think the world would look like if that were normalized. Would it be a numbers thing, or would it be you would feel differently in those parent conversations, or what would happen?
It'd be like a conversation thing. Like you were saying, you were at Michigan State. So, you know, you're in a crowd and you see somebody with a Michigan State hat on and, you know, they're in a sea of people with University of Michigan clothes on, and you walk across the room to that person with the Michigan State hat on, and you have what, you know, Kurt Vonnegut called this a grand falloon. You have this sort of, you know, fake connection, like, you and I, we both went to Michigan State, or you and I both taught at Michigan State, and you have that connection. So what would it look like if it was normalized? It would be something where, you know, men who were in this role as lead dads would have other guys they could talk to. And I'm not saying that, you know, look, guys make fun of each other all the time. That's sort of in our nature. But it's a lot more difficult talking to guys who are the traditional go-to-work dad. Like I joke, like, could I imagine, you know, Friday afternoon, I get away in the summer, I play a round of golf, I have a great time, and I sit for a beer afterwards, and everyone's checking their phones, and I look at my phone, and I shout out, oh my God, can you believe how hard it is to get a 5-year-old into ballet in this town? And those guys are going to look at me like, Sullivan, I thought this is your first beer. Like, what are you doing? Like, are you out of your mind? But when you have, you know, lead dads and you can talk and you have that community, it's a normal conversation. And I'll add one thing, you know, when that last piece in the Times ran, the sort of first thing that really kicked off the Company of Dads, I had men come up to me who I've known for 6-7 years. I mean, we've lived in this area for 14 years now. Men I've known who our kids have gone to school together. I've stood on the sidelines at games together. You know, maybe we've played a round of golf together, something like that. We know each other. And they've come up, several of them came up to me and said, you know, I heard about what you're doing. I was like, yeah. It's like, you know, I'd like to be a part of it. It's like, great, cool. Just promise me one thing. Okay. Just don't use my name. Can I just be anonymous? And I looked at them and I realized they were serious. And I said, you know, this isn't like Cruella de Vil where we're taking like Dalmatians and like skinning them or anything like that. You know, this is just guys getting together and talking and we just happen to be doing something that's a little bit different. And they look at me so seriously, like, yeah, but you're not going to use my name, right? I was like, no, I won't use your name. And that to me is sort of part of the problem. These guys are
yeah,
doing
it's a coming
this.
Out process.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a coming out process. They're doing it. They're enjoying it. But there's something about their sense of self, something about their sense of masculinity that doesn't allow them to talk openly about this with their guy friends.
Paul wants to make a space for men to feel openly good about their roles as primary caregivers in their families. But he's also clear that part of the reason he wants people to see and to respect lead dads is that if we want women to have the chance to succeed in their professions, we have to recognize that sometimes this requires spouses who do the primary caregiving, and sometimes those spouses will be men, the gender that doesn't normally take the parenting lead. The term itself, lead dads, is really interesting to me, and I was hoping you would unpack it. You know, traditionally, when women are talked about as doing what you're talking about, lead dads doing, it's called stay at home.
Don't say it. Don't say that.
Stay at home, mom. And I used to say to people, I don't stay at home. Like, we're out all the time. Like, either, you know, I'm out doing stuff and the neighbor's watching the kid, or he's out with me. Like, he's out doing things with me. So the idea that somehow I'm sitting at home, like, mending the socks. No, I'm balancing my work with his schedule. Tragically, I'm the one who needs the naps. It would really work better if he was the one who needed the naps. Yeah. So why did you come up with the language of lead dad?
Tell us about how you got there.
What else did you consider, for example?
Not stay-at-home dad. I mean, that is the worst acronym in the world, because when you put it all together, what does it spell? It spells sad. It couldn't be any worse.
Actually, I think it spells sad.
Sad.
It's even worse.
You're extending it like sad.
Sad. He's so sad.
And so, look, stay-at-home anything is inactive. It is passive. Does anybody want to be inactive and passive?
My pet rats, but yes, nobody.
One of my gajillion pets is a big fat cat, and she is very passive.
She's a stay-at-home cat.
She's a stay-at-home.
She's
afraid of everybody. She is sack. But what is lead? Lead is active. Lead is positive. Lead is proactive. You are the lead dad. And when my final column ran in the New York Times, I got blowback from... I would say 95% positive, but the 5% blowback was from women who had that traditional parenting role. And they said, look, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom. Why do I have to be called the stay-at-home mom when you're called the lead dad? And I said, you don't. Right. And I think it's horrible that you embrace the term stay-at-home parent. It's an awful, dismissive term that's rooted in like the 1960s.
Paul explained in our interview, the full version of which you can hear by subscribing to our tangent tier, that part of how he made all this work in his own family was that when he had to go into New York City once a week for his job at the Times, his father would come and stay for 2 or 3 days to overlap with that time. Mike and I had similar arrangements where we had family and neighbors helping. Another thing I think we all have in common is the joy of the little things that happen when you're with your kids all day long. If you had to think of one sort of iconic moment that would sort of encapsulate the feeling of, God, this was all worth it in terms of the reorganization of my life to be the lead parent, what would that moment look like? What memory comes to mind?
Oh, man. I mean, the positive. I mean, I've never, I don't think I've ever thought of it in those terms because, you know, there, it's not like any grand moment. It's like the ability, when my daughter wants to go do something at 3:30 in the afternoon and it's, can we go ride my bike down the street, which I know is going to take about 45 minutes and to be able to say, okay, I can do that. Or it's, you know, my daughter wanted to, it was raining on Friday. Another daughter wanted to go bowling. And I'm like, I don't know. I guess we could go bowling at 4 o'clock. It's not that far from here. And so we did. We went bowling, you know, and again, you're with a small child. You're not bowling for 5 hours. You're bowling for an hour. So to have that flexibility and to be able to be present and then to know that I can make up whatever work I have at night. I mean, that those are the moments that I really cherish.
Paul, Mike, and I got to talking about how we manage working at home with kids underfoot, particularly when you have little kids who don't really understand what work is. They think work is you go to a store or a factory or an office, not you're going to the attic.
We've lived in two houses since we've been parents. First house, and we had to buy a bigger house because we have more kids. And both of those houses had attics where there was office space. And so, you know, if when you set the expectation from the beginning, kids get it. And so, like, when the door was, and unfortunately, the first house was a really old house that hadn't been terribly well maintained. So the door, it was hard to open the door to my office in the attic. It literally stuck. And so they really couldn't even get in. And now, unfortunately, the door works just fine and they can open it. But they got it for the most part. Like, as long as nothing was going wrong and they were playing or they were doing whatever, it was fine. When it would go south is when they would have a fight and they would race to get up the stairs to tell on the other person, because that's, you know, what you do. And I'll say this, you know, prior to 2019, it was a lot more challenging because, you know, my desk line, it's a 212 number. It's in the New York area, New York City area code, even though I'm living in Connecticut and making all the calls from here. So it's, again, came back to me sort of faking a lot. And so you would sort of, you know, you'd be on this call, and this is, people weren't doing Zooms prior to 2020. So you didn't have to worry about, you know, kid running in. And I'd literally mute the call and be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I could, you know, shaking my hands and all this. Like, get the fuck out of here. You're fine. You're not going to, is anybody bleeding? Nobody's bleeding. And then I go, well, that's an interesting point you just made. Let me ask you a follow-up question to that. Which is essentially the same question I already asked, because I didn't hear what the person said and I had to take notes all over again. And now it's gotten, you know, if anything, it's gotten a little easier in the moments when they have to come in and there's a Zoom. One, if they see the image of other people, they'll just kind of, you know, close the door. Two, if they come in, unless you're a horrible human being, you understand that in this world that we live in, kids are going to walk into your office. I mean, if we remember back, there was this, you know, the famous guy.
Oh, I love that
BBC
video.
Guy. The BBC yeah. guy. Oh,
I still
my goodness.
Watch it now then because it makes me feel good.
Hilarious.
Where, but like, his kid comes into the room in one of those Zoom around little machines and his wife comes in yes. being like, oh my God, I'm sorry. But
his wife is like pulling the kid out of there. Like, it's like the greatest catch or something like this. Like, this is a prize tuna and she's trying to, like, you know, reel it in and pull it back out. The kid's flopping around like the tuna.
And he just,
like,
keeps talking the whole time.
Keeps yeah. talking, unfazed. But like, that thing went viral. That is now, fortunately, like, so mundane. It's just a part of our lives that nobody would even care. Nobody would even react. And so if anything, that's, you know, at least one baby step in the right direction. Because, like, as I said earlier in this, like, 2019, we're not going back to it. You know, work and family cannot be separate anymore. If you want to have a good work environment and have people doing their best, you have to acknowledge that people who are parents are going to have parenting responsibilities. And, you know, look, if my, fortunately, my parents aren't so old yet, but like, people who have older parents are going to have older parent responsibilities. We have to acknowledge this, or else, you know, certain companies will acknowledge this and the best performing employees will go to those companies because they'll say, look, they have a better package. They understand this. This is how the world is in 2022. And of course, what's that going to mean? The companies that don't adapt, they're going to be stuck with the worst performing employees. Because as I said to all these companies, like, your worst performers will never leave because they're your worst performers and they're not employable elsewhere. So you have to get on board here.
I enjoyed what you said about the door. You probably can't see it because it's a little far away, but there's no door handle on the external part of my office door. And it fell off about 2 years ago. And my wife, about 3 years ago, my wife has been bothering me since then. She's like, why don't you put it? And I've just been thinking, it's different now because my son's older, but there was a time, especially when we first moved into this house, we had an office in our last house as well, but the door could be closed, but if he's just got the vacuum popper and going through, he'll just open the door and come in and do his thing. And,
push toy that goes pop, 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 pop.
So, but when this fell off, he was about 3 or 4. And at first it was like, well, it's an old door. It's an expensive handle and I don't really care that much. And then I tried to get a handle and I thought, you know what? I think this is a good situation.
That's going. Fantastic.
I just told my wife, I said, I don't know if there's a big thud and you don't hear from me for a while, I guess you could be worried. But he's older now. I might get it fixed, but it definitely set the expectation of, hey, you know, mom comes home from work after dinner, dad's going to go in his office, the door's going to close, and let's just pretend he's not here for the next, and I'll come out to like help put you to bed or whatever. But I enjoyed the whatever fate happened that the handle fell off. But I think it fell off because he was trying to get in here one day and it just popped off.
But the part you leave out, you were fighting on the other end. So he was trying to push, you were pulling it.
Yeah. And I just kind of have thought, well, this has worked out beautifully for me. So I'm just gonna leave it off here.
It's a lot cheaper than getting some biometric eye scan when he comes to the door. So I like
Mike and I talked after the interview with Paul about the company of dads and the term lead dad. We both noticed that Paul is trying to raise the status of primary caregiving fatherhood by imbuing it with the aura of white-collar professionalism, calling it the company of dads, and looking for corporate buy-in. We get it, but it does feel a little bit ironic. Mike also said he has some ambivalence about it all because he's naturally suspicious of identity-based groupings. But one thing Mike did say was that he'd like some company from other fathers in similar situations because of the way he finds himself misunderstood when he goes out into the world as a primary caregiving father. Here's a clip about that from my conversation that was one-on-one with Mike. At the beginning, he refers to our interview with the psychologist Jonathan Adler, which we're going to get to in just a little bit. Just as a reminder, you can hear more of all of our interviews, including the conversation between me and Mike, by subscribing to the Tangent tier.
One thing I do like, but I do like about it because there are, and I'm not oppressed here. I'm like straight white cis dad, so I have many luxuries, but there have been a number of situations where I definitely feel like the other, because as when we were talking to Jonathan Adler, I kept talking about the other moms, me being one of them, and where I'm the one, the lone constant male presence. And I definitely feel that there's a shift if I enter the room or if I'm part of the group, or maybe, I feel like there's some sort of conversation or relationship that's ongoing that I'm not a part of. I just happen to be.
Yeah. You're the party crasher. Yeah.
And so I definitely get that. Or, this has only happened a few times, thankfully, but especially before Hudson went to school, we go get groceries during the day, I'd bring him with me. And, the cashier would be like, oh, you're watching him today. And I was well, actually I watch him every day, but thank you. When I first joined, before I was on the ethics board, I served on a budget committee in town. And one of the people, we were talking about setting up meetings and I would regularly reference my schedule. I'd say, I'm with my son these times.
Right.
I don't want to schedule. And someone came up to me after a meeting, was like, oh, so are you like a divorcee and you only get your kid on certain days? And I was like, well, I'm kind of impressed that you just came up and asked me that question. I was like, no, it's just, I watch my son and I'm with my son most of the day. And when I'm with him, I cannot be committing to these other things, And they found that, they thought it was just kind of an interesting curiosity, but all they could deduce from me talking about my son was I must be divorced and I must be stuck with him like 3 days a week. You know,
because no normal father would be watching his son.
Yeah. And so I run into those things, but I mean, I don't think, you know, I'm oppressed or anything like that, but I do like the idea
in there. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like the idea, like, of what Paul's doing, of there being a community of folks with similar situation who are in a similar situation. And you can relate to one another in ways that you probably can't with most other people, regardless of sex or gender.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the uphill battles for him will be that, you know, the stereotype of men is that they're strong all the time. And so what Paul's really created, I mean, I consider it a support group because that's essentially what it is. Even if it's a for-profit enterprise, it's still a support group fundamentally. And I think there's a little bit of a challenge of getting men to join support groups when they feel like they're doing fine. And I think a lot of men who are caring for their kids like you feel like you're doing fine. It's just nice to have somebody else to talk to now and then, which I know you and I enjoyed doing, like, well, frankly, complaining to each other when we felt like there was one of those moments where our spouses didn't quite understand what we were living through.
Yeah. And I have, like, as I've said before, you were the first and for a while the only capital F friend I had who was in a similar situation as, like, the primary caregiver. Since then, one of my best friends has also become the primary caregiver to his two girls. And sometimes he'll just reach out to me purely in that role and just be like,
oh yeah,
I'm losing my mind. I remember one time he called me, he's like, and he's like, I'm losing my mind here. And I said, that's fine, man. Lay it on me, please. You know, I've been there. I understand.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it's odd because, like, a number of my other male friends who are parents, they're all, I can say this sincerely, they're all great supportive parents and they're very active. But, you know, they weren't necessarily there with, you know, for 7 to 10 hours a day, you know, every day when there's just a lump shitting its pants, you know, like repeatedly.
Or when the lump shitting its pants gets a little older and they're still shitting their pants now and then at random intervals. And on top of that, they're talking back to you in ways that when they're bitchy, I mean, they can be so intense. Like, I just remember there was this one time where fortunately my spouse was home for it because it would have sent me over the edge. But my kid kicked me hard and I, like, picked him up, put him in his room, and I said, you can come out when you apologize. And he spent 45 minutes screaming through the door, I don't have enough energy to say I'm sorry.
Yeah.
45 minutes of this. And, you know, my spouse was home so we could chuckle to each other. But when you're alone and that's happening, it's a completely different experience. And it's like at least for me, my whole psyche is like, how did I get in this situation? I am too professional a person. I've worked too hard on my life to be in a situation where I'm basically being run around by a terrorist who's significantly shorter than me. It's a really upsetting kind of moment when the kids are doing that to you and you feel like, my God, you know, I have an advanced degree. I had a career that was much more organized than it is now. How did this happen to me? And the amount of resentment that, at least for me, you know, that you can ball up, like, towards your spouse and towards your kid and towards the universe can get pretty significant. I think that's part of the reason I liked knowing you, because a lot of what I felt like I wanted to attribute to sexism, but it's actually not. It's more of this white collar thing, but it's more like it's this thing about that parenting is devalued compared to professional life. And as a consequence, you just feel belittled all the time in that situation.
I have to ask how old he was when this happened. Do you remember?
He was like 4. Okay. You know, and you know him. I mean, he's a perfectly charming young man now.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to have him on for an episode.
I mean, I was assuming it wasn't last week. But he was
4.
No, because Hudson definitely, he, you know, and I tell people, like, as far as, you know, because you never know, of course. And I hear with people with siblings, like they can be like night and day from one to the other. Mm-hmm. Hudson is overall has been and continues to be, you know, hopefully I'm not jinxing myself, a very easy child.
Oh,
you know,
all things same considered. Way. Classically
but,
easy.
You know, it didn't change the fact that there were like he hit for a while too. And he was a hitter, and which is weird because like I don't know where he got that from necessarily. You know, it's not like he sees us hitting each other or hitting him on a regular basis.
They just pick it up.
But like there, I won't say where. If you're, I don't know if you're ever in my neck of the woods, I'll point it out to you. But there is a wall somewhere in our house where there's a little dent in it because he was being such an asshole one day, and it was, I don't know if he was. Because people talk about terrible twos or threes. He was great until about four and a half. And then for whatever reason, the second half of four was an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
And there was, we had just been screaming at each other like all day.
Yep.
At this point.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure the neighbors could, and this was like, it wasn't warm out. All the windows were closed. I'm pretty sure all the neighbors could hear the two of us just going at it.
Yeah.
And I put him in his bed, I slammed the door, and then I just hit the wall as hard as I could. And with an open hand, it wasn't a fist. I don't, you know, because of course I play an instrument, so I don't want to break a knuckle. But I was, you know, I slammed the wall as hard as I could. And then I noticed, I made a big dent. There's like a big, it's not, you'd have to really look to know, you have to look for it to see it. But like, I know where it is. And you know, it's like, what am I going to do? Bring in a contractor to get a whole new section of drywall, because I just, you know, it's nothing I can fix myself, but it's now big enough to
hang
where
a picture over it, hang a large piece of art over it.
And a couple days later, he was like, you know, he tried telling Chris, he's like, yeah, Daddy hit the wall the other day. And I said, just let's not even talk about it. But I remember just, and then when it was done, not when it was done, but after I did that, and then I saw what I did to the wall, and I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I destroying my property? Because I'm so mad at him. And he just makes me want to tear my eyes out. But I mean, those days definitely happened. Thankfully they were the minority, but yeah, I mean.
Oh, but then the killer is, right? The spouse comes home and the kid immediately changes behavior.
Yeah.
In my experience. Becomes totally normal at that point. And any account that I'm trying to relay of how hellish the day has been rings totally hollow. Mike, Paul, and I all had the same basic reason for shifting our careers to be very present primary caregivers. We all felt like we couldn't understand why we would have kids and then hire someone else to care for and raise them if we could do it ourselves. We also found that having kids awakened something in us that made us want to be with our kids, something that I think most parents experience, although we talk less about it with fathers than we do with mothers.
You know, I was never I still am outside of Hudson, I guess, but I've never been a kid person generally. So
same
like
here.
Had you asked me, maybe not one, but probably two or three years prior, like if that's the situation I would have been in, I probably would have just laughed or something. But so, I mean, that's not something I would have gravitated toward prior to that. But then when I was in it, and I knew abstractly going in, you know, we had planned when we were intentionally trying to get Kristen pregnant. I know people say we, but, you know, you know, that's a part of the process that I know nothing about, is actually being pregnant. And so, like we had planned that I would, because of my schedule and the possibilities related to them, the circumstances related to my schedule and work life, I could make it work to stay home with them. So like we planned for it, but you know, a couple weeks into it, I was like, well, this is far more drastic and severe than I had anticipated it being, you know, which was just kind of a shock to me. And I made it work, and I continued to do it, and I still do it in a sense, even though he's in school full time now. But yeah, it was just quite the shock of, you know, just sitting around, me and him staring at each other, I guess, for hours on end, especially.
Oh my gosh. And babies are so boring.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're an intellectual, which you are and I am, like, babies are so boring. Like, you can entertain them and get different stuff out of them, but like, one thing changes per day. It goes very quickly over the course of 6 months, but like, one thing changes per day and it is so freaking boring. And yeah. I just remember when my son Kepler was like 6 months old that I went into work and one of the people I work with said, "How's Kepler?" And I said, "Oh my God, he's finally better than a puppy."
Yeah.
And I was like, because before that I was thinking, why the hell didn't we get a puppy? Other than the fact that my spouse was allergic, so we couldn't get a puppy. I think if he hadn't been allergic, we probably never would have had children. But you know, then, I mean, I think you, like I, also found it incredibly rewarding. Like,
yes.
you and I gossip sometimes about people who have full-time nannies or put their kids in daycare, you know, 14 hours a day. And I just can't relate to that because I actually, it came as a surprise to me. I really liked my kid.
Yeah.
I had a child assuming I would like it, but I had no idea how much I would get to like it and how much I would enjoy the person who started talking, especially when they start talking and telling you what's in that little head. And then they start building things and they start describing things. And it just becomes kind of incredible at that point.
Oh yeah. Well, it was funny when I think it was my friend Matt Borgi who said one of the first times where he visited after Hudson was born, because he also lived in East Lansing, he commented to my wife, he was like, "It's the first time I've ever seen Mike be nurturing to anybody or anything." I mean, I really took to it, and like I don't know if it's because I'm an only child, but I'm very possessive. I don't like to share things, and so part of us wanting to have one of us be with him all the time was, you know, might sound silly, but I'm thinking like, well, this is my kid, so we are going to raise him, you know,
right?
Like, that's I'm not how going, I felt. I don't want to share him with the daycare. I don't want to share him with, you know, paid help or whatever. We did have a babysitter occasionally for one stretch, but that was basically just to help me out like one or two mornings a week after he turned one. But it was almost, you know, there was an aspect of it where I looked at him, I viewed him almost as like a personal project of like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to accomplish this. You know, and there was all the nurturing that went along and I was, you know, overall happy to do it. Sometimes it was very frustrating and depressing, but it was like, no, I don't want anyone else being a part of this. You know, it's the same reason why I can't share, you know, now that he's older and sometimes he'll see things of mine he wants to share and Kristen will get in between us like a parent, you know, because she'll be like, just let him use your pencil or whatever. I'm like, well, that's my pencil. I don't want him taking it. But I almost viewed him that way in a weird sense when he was born of like, I don't want anyone else taking care of him.
When we were talking about all this, one of the things I kept trying to figure out was how much of the negative we felt was due to sexism. For me, as a mother, the world's assumption that a woman would, of course, subsume her career and her income to motherhood, even as I tried to maintain my career. And for Mike, as a father, the assumption so many people had that he wasn't really the primary caregiver, that he was an interloper in the mom space. I was glad we made time to talk with my friend Jonathan Adler about his own experiences as a father, as there is no mom in his household. John is a professor of psychology at Olin College who specializes in the role of narrative in psychological experiences and in therapy. We talked with him for another episode about life narratives, but we also tacked on to that interview a bunch of questions about what it's been like for him to be raising his two children with his husband. I was wondering what he noticed about gender and parenting and the expectations that people have. Do you experience any of that, like, weirdness when you're in the room and it's mostly the moms?
I mean, we comment on that all the time, the ways in which it falls to the moms to do the emotional labor of things, meaning, you know, running the bake sale or, you know, even I'm a pretty active member. Our elementary school has like a families anti-racist, you know, group we're trying to work on making changes within the local elementary school to impact both the curriculum, but also the, you know, the way things impact families. And I'm very often the only man there. Sometimes there's one or two other men there. And again, this is in liberal, progressive, suburban Boston. So we comment on it all the time. I haven't experienced the kind of overt hostility or that feeling that my presence changes the room. But what I notice is there is there's a mom ecosystem that I am welcome in, but not invited into. When I end up in those spaces, I don't feel that I'm disrupting it in some way, but I also get this sense of like, there's some text stream that I'm not on, that all of these people are on. And I don't think it's willful exclusion. I really think it is like, oh, who do I need to text about this? So-and-so's mom and so-and-so's mom and so-and-so's mom. And it's just like, those are the people who come to mind. So I don't ever have the feeling that I'm being purposefully excluded, but I sometimes do have the feeling of being passively not included.
So when you were growing up, did you expect someday to be married with kids?
I did. You know, I grew up in liberal, progressive Metro Boston. But I also, you know, my own understanding of my sexual orientation, you know, took a long time to sort of evolve in for myself. But yeah, I really, even as a child and as an adolescent, really wanted to be a parent. So it really has always been part of my identity. And I remember when I came out to my parents, which was not till I was 20 or 21, I remember one of the, you know, they were very supportive, but one of the first things they said is like, oh, but now you won't have kids. And I thought, what? Yes, I will. I don't know how I'm going to do that, but yes, I will be a parent. That's something I've always wanted. Yeah.
And when you met your husband, was that a sort of deal breaker for you in terms of when you were dating people?
Yeah, definitely it was. It was something, you know, you don't bring it up on the first date, but it's definitely something that we needed to talk about early on. And we have a good friend who is a gay man who is single, wants to be a parent, but has not found a partner who is interested in that. And it's been a deal breaker for him.
That's really hard. I mean, that's hard for everybody who wants to raise a kid with somebody and can't find somebody. That's just really, really tough.
Right.
So, you know, when we go out into the world in America, most people still assume that a family will be a man and a woman and kids. And we were wondering, do you find yourself being subject to that idea that one parent is supposed to be motherly and one is supposed to be fatherly? And what does that look like?
Yeah, it's really complicated. So again, we live in liberal, progressive, suburban Boston. So no one in our orbit has ever said, like, who's the mom? Which I've definitely heard, you know, people who live in other parts of the country have just had people ask that question directly.
And by who's the mom, you don't mean who was the biological mother. Which one of you puts on the apron and plays
exactly
the mom?
Which one of you fills the mom role?
Yeah.
So we don't get that. So it's much more, it shows up much more implicitly, like who gets called from the school if a kid is sick and needs to get picked up. And we have experimented over the years, like every year we have to go into the school portal and put in all the contact information. And we have experimented with, does it matter who's parent one, listed as parent one or parent two, or does the school think of one of us as the mom? And it turns out, to our school's great credit, nope, it's whoever is listed as parent one gets called. So those are the ways in which that comes up. But I will say because we are so fortunate to live in this, you know, very accepting part of the country, the place where it does come up the most is in trying to find books or TV shows or whatever for our kids. I mean, they just don't see examples of our family anywhere. And it is now like a family joke that books, TV shows, whatever, it's always mom and dad. And they're always like, why isn't it my parents instead of my mom and my dad? Why does it always have to be? And the kids certainly notice the gendered ways in which moms show up versus dads show up in the various media that they consume. And, you know, we have really gone out of our way to find books in particular that portray two dad families. But so many of those books are, I have two dads. My dad cooks dinner. My papa does blah, blah. And it's those books are boring.
Yeah.
We needed those books when we had toddlers. Like, those are fine board books to say, like, daddy makes dinner. Papa ties my shoes, blah, blah, blah. But our 6 and 8 year old are not interested in the story of, like, wow, I have two dads and that's okay. And there just aren't that many stories where the narrative is actually an interesting story. And oh yeah, the character happens to have two dads.
By the way,
we have found those. And man, do we go look for them and go out of our way to include them, but they are few and far between.
Yeah. And does one of you function as the primary caregiver generally?
No, we really don't. This is something, again, we've been together for almost 20 years. This summer, it'll be 20 years. From very early on in our relationship, we really talked about having sort of an egalitarian marriage, an egalitarian partnership. And so it's not that we don't have tasks that we each sort of specialize in. So like we joke that my husband is the CFO and I'm the purchasing manager, right? Like, so we have things that we do. And I had a much more luxurious parental leave from work when our kids were born. So I was home with the babies a lot longer, but that was really about the structures of our different workplaces than anything. So no, I mean, it is not, one of us is not the cook. One of us is not the, you know, make sure the backpack has the things that it needs to have in it. One of us is not the go to the PTO meetings. We really do share those roles. One of us, you know, we take turns, we have two kids and there's two of us. So we just flip flop bedtimes every night. We really, again, it's not that there aren't tasks that one of us tends to do more than the other, but it's not, they're not along typical gendered lines.
So do you think your kids are missing anything by not having a mother, a biological mother in the household? Or not biological. What I mean is a female in the household.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I don't know how to answer the missing piece. Would our lives be different if there was a woman in the household? Yes. So our lives are different. But I don't know, missing implies that there's some standard against which you can measure a lack. And I tend to think children need like loving parents. And as long as they've got that, they've got what they need. Like that's the threshold, loving parents who can, you know, who can take care of them. So I really construe it not so much as are they missing something, but I also am not pretending that our family is not different. It's sort of like an analogy maybe works to like my son's best friends are twins and they have a black father and a white mother. And so, right, we don't take a colorblind approach. Like, are they missing something by not having two parents of the same race? I mean, yes, their family would be different if their parents were of the same race, but I don't think they're missing something. They just have something different.
Yeah. And as I recall, I mean, last time I looked at the data suggested that the kids with same gender parents do just fine. It's not any different.
Yeah. In terms certainly of the literature is very clear that all the outcomes.
There is all that literature about, you know, if children are raised by single mothers, that they're at risk for all sorts of things. But, you know, I think that what appears to matter more than having a father is having enough adults around to make up for when one adult is stressed, right?
Exactly. I think
the key is to have the village situation where in the United States, we've narrowed that down to mostly just two parents. But, you know, a lot of us do rely on additional adults around to help us. I know for Mike, for example, his in-laws live nearby and they often help out.
Right. Same here. We live really close to my parents. They're super involved. We live close to my sister and her family and they're very involved. But one of my closest friends is a single mom by choice, has two kids, and her parents are very involved in helping raise her kids. So yes, I think it's not about, it's really about, are there enough resources, both like financial resources, but also human resources like time, bandwidth, attention to meet the child's needs.
I think it must have been because we were talking for this episode primarily about fathers and specifically about two-parent households that I kept obnoxiously forgetting that Mike had been raised by one parent, his mother, exclusively. Although, as for all our kids, with the help of other adults, in his case, his maternal grandparents. Mike brought this up at this point in our conversation with John.
I was actually, I never do this, but I was going to interject to piggyback on the last two items, because I was raised by a single mom and with no memory of my biological father. He was not, it was by choice that he was not a part of my life, probably as far as I can understand for the better. But people would always ask me growing up, and even now, almost on eggshells, like, oh, well, what was it like not having him around? You know, were you upset about it? Are you, you know, do you have feelings now? You're almost 40 years old. Were you missing? And it's completely honest, I think about that as much as I think about like Mandarin grammar, which is not at all, because nothing was taken away from my perspective. So nothing was missing. You know, it was my mom, my grandparents were very involved with my life, and it worked out. You know, the most I think about it now is if my wife brings it up, you know, when she was pregnant, she was like, you know, does your biological father have health issues we need to know about? And I said, you know, I don't know. And so I weirdly, very uncomfortably asked my mom, you know, I said, you know, if you can think way back, were there health, you know, did he cough a lot or something that, you know, do you remember? And she said, no. And then, you know, now my son who's 7 will occasionally, you know, oh, well, I have one grandma and then one grandma and grandpa. Where's the other grandpa? I just said, you know, most of your friends have siblings. You're an only child. Some kids have one parent. Some kids have two. And he just says, okay, that's it.
Families look all kinds of different ways.
Mike is clear. He didn't experience any lack in his childhood. You know how the typical story about men raised without fathers is that they're depressed criminals, maybe living on the street? Yeah, Mike is not only a successful musician, a manager of a software company, the chair of the ethics board of his town, and the guy who's running arts night at the local public school this year. He's also such an involved parent that he is the primary caregiver to his son. And that's not because he's compensating for the lack of a father in his life. It's because he's emulating his mother, who was always very actively involved in Mike's life, even as she managed a full-time job. Paradoxically, Mike attributes his unusually involved fatherhood as being due to having been raised by a very good mother, who managed to be a very good mother while working a full-time job outside the home. He told me that one of the rare times he wondered about his father was just after his own son Hudson was born, when he wondered about the other side of this lineage. He and I also talked about the primal urge we feel to protect our kids, even from ourselves.
It was weird. I think, you know, for people, I don't know who this would be, people that maybe would have known me 10 years ago but don't anymore might be shocked to see me being.
I always say that about myself, that if the person I was back then could see the person I became as a parent, she would be shocked and kind of appalled, you know, because I became a very different person. I think for the better, but much less, you know, working 90 hours a week kind of thing. And
yeah,
also weirdly maternal. I mean, I didn't expect that of myself, but I'm not a gooey mother. I, you know, my kid calls kind of on a schedule about once a week. I see him every now and then. It's totally fine. I'm not one of these parents that has to hear from her kid all the time, but I will say, you know, like you, it's sort of the kid brings this thing out in you that, even when you want to kill them, like you would kill somebody else to protect them. I mean, there's this thing in you that's like, it becomes the tiger and you would do anything to protect that thing.
I destroyed the house to protect him from my anger that one day. So
and that's the irony, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that where you will, you literally hurt yourself all the time for the sake of your children. And it's kind of shocking how that happens. Yeah.
There was a question you had asked. I only mentioned this just because it was a fun memory. You asked when there was a question you put down about when my son was not boring anymore. I don't know if this is like the demarcation, but the first time I got him to laugh.
Oh God. Yeah.
As a genuine response.
For real. Right.
Yeah. That
not
was
a survival laugh, but an actual responsive laugh.
Yeah. It was a game changer. Like we were just sitting
totally.
There. I think it was, I don't know. He might have been like 5 months old or something. Because I want to say it was like late spring.
Yeah,
he was born in January, so it was probably around May. Because yeah. I know it was, you know, in the saving grace of the situation with not Hudson, but with Kristen being a teacher, she can help more in the summers, you know, and it can even out a little bit. But this was, I was with him all day, and you know, this is like hour three of me laying on the chase. With him, yep. with him on my chest, we were just like yep. listening to music, and I'm, yeah. you know, just like moving his arms to like entertain
both
you know,
of
mildly
you.
Entertain yep. one of us, and I don't know, I did something, and it actually legitimately scared me the first time he did it because he hadn't done it before, you know, and
right,
I was like, what the hell did he just do? Because he had like this demonic look on his face. And if you heard a recording of it, you would think it was laughter, but he hadn't done it as a response before. So then it scared me. And then I composed myself and I thought, I think he just laughed. And then, so I kind of did it again. And then he laughed again. And that was, it was at least a small game changer.
Oh, when total game changer.
It went from being this little lump to yep. who, and he had a personality or whatever, as much as you can as an infant. But it was like, oh, we can interact.
Yes.
We're not just gonna exist
no, it's
together.
Like, oh God, I mean something to you. Finally, you know, after yeah. keeping you alive all this time and killing myself for you, I actually mean something to you.
Yeah. yeah. If memory serves me correctly, he ended up throwing up on me an hour later because I was doing so much to try to get him to laugh that I was just jiggling him around and he just all over me on the chase. But
that's awesome.
But it was more from motion sickness than anything else. Cause I was like,
yeah.
I was like a scientist just trying to discover electricity or something. I was like, oh, I gotta keep doing it over and over and over again. But yeah, it was a good day.
So back to our question, can a father be a mother? That's obviously the wrong question. It doesn't really seem to matter if you're male or female, with your partner's genders matched or unmatched to yours, or even whether you're partnered. As with so much in life, what seems to matter is showing up day after day after day. My kid is graduating on time. I'm glad I had the bandwidth to help him with that this week. And I'm glad we have a relationship where he lets me help him when he hits a wall. I'm looking forward to giving Mike the script for this episode when he gets back from his vacation with his mom.
This is Just Answer the Question, a thinking podcast created by Alice Dreger and produced by Michael Teeger. Mixing and mastering services were provided by Risky Studios. Today's guests were Paul Sullivan and Jonathan Adler. Subscribing to our podcast gets you notifications of when new episodes drop, and it also gives you access to the Tangent tier, including full recordings with our guests.
where you can hear more stories, ideas, and back chatter. Subscribe on your favorite pod platform or go to our website, jatqpod.com. The music you heard on today's episode was created and performed by Michael Teeger. That's me. You can learn more about Alice's work and my work by checking out the links provided at jatqpod.com. Just Answer the Question is assembled under the auspices of Michigoose Productions, LLC.
Say onion.
Hey.
Say weather.
Weather.
Say bye-bye.
Bye-bye.